All right, welcome back to the Slapshot Alley podcast. My name is Andre. I'm here with Cliff. How are you doing, Cliff?
I'm doing good.
Today we've had a new kid come into the facility here and work on their shooting. And it's basically a very similar story that happens every time a new player comes in here. I ask them, have you ever had a shooting lesson before? And most kids are kind of like, well, you know, I've seen demonstrations on the ice, but nobody's really kind of broken it down for me. And today I was able to help a 9-year-old kid who didn't really understand the idea of front foot forward.
Yeah.
And that's the big thing I learned with you, is like how to really work on your balance and acceleration with the shot to the net and shooting in stride.
A lot of it, you know, you're going to UBC and understanding mechanics of the body makes a huge difference. I mean, you're a guy that doesn't like to talk about your side of things, but you know, you're schooled on it. And then myself working with you over the past 9 years, we've really dialed in how you teach kids at all levels. But the biggest thing I think at Slapshot Alley is, what drills do you do to take out bad habits? And what drills do you do to teach them how to shoot harder and more accurate? And that's something that you dialed in for sure. And it shows on the board. A kid comes here 2 or 3 times, instantly their shot becomes better, and they get their confidence, and then they go home and practice proper technique, and guess what? You end up getting the result of a 70-mile-an-hour shot, 76 I see up on the board. I see some young kids with 53 in Adam. That's pretty good, so we're having a lot of fun here.
Today I had Abraham. Abraham is a player from St. Albert who moved here to play with an academy, and he is in Pee Wee shooting 68 miles per hour.
Holy smokes.
So just a top level player and still needs to work on balance, you know, like he's really, really strong. He's working hard every day on fitness, but you know, I'd say the big thing that these kids like want to improve on is the balance and getting, you know, just once you get the balance, then you can put more force into the shot.
Absolutely. I mean, the biggest thing we always talk about is toe down and load up the stick, weight transfer. I mean, a lot of times when you say it to kids, they don't really understand it. But the beauty of what you're doing here is you're using a video, high-speed video, and showing a professional and then showing them, and then they start like copycatting a little bit, and they pick it up a lot quicker, these kids, by video. And it's been great. I've been excited when I hear a kid peewee hockey shooting 63 miles an hour. This is good stuff.
I tell you, another big story that happened today was Leo. He doesn't speak English, and he's like a sponge, like probably like you. He's looking at the video, and he's using the NHL player side-by-side comparison, and today he got up to 71 miles per hour.
Holy smokes.
1 month ago, he was only shooting in the 50s because he just learned how to take a slap shot. And, you know, today I can see him talking to his mom. He's like, look, I know how to hit the ice now about the toe down and stuff like that.
That's awesome.
He had the confidence, right?
Like you said, I mean, I know I've worked with some players yourself too. Shea Weber, big ally of Frady. The best guys ever in history on slap shots load up the stick, toe down. And, you know, you can just watch on video, you can see it. And it's something that once you understand the technique and teach the technique, these kids get excited. And then, you know what? Just having a great shot might help them make the team, might be the difference maker for making the team. Oh, that kid, he's got a good shot, we'll take him. And that's what happens in these tryouts coming up.
Well, when you start ripping shots and burning goaltenders, the game obviously starts to get fun.
Yeah.
And so, you know, your effort level goes up that much more when you get that confidence.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's move on to the power meter. So this thing has got we've got about 5-10 kids that are, the first thing they do when they get in here is they head on over there, they walk over there, and they want to see where they're at and where everybody else is at. It's getting them competitive.
That's what you want. You want you want competitive in a good way. I just kind of look over and I notice it kind of looks like the Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
In a different format.
Some kids think it looks like a volcano, but...
I see Stanley Cup.
And the good thing about it is it's got age categories. You know, that way the kids don't get too discouraged, right?
Absolutely.
And we've had a couple of tykes that don't really understand the age categories, so I've had to kind of explain it to them because I can see them kind of tear up a little bit. But in all good fun.
That's good.
They end up getting it. And,
nice.
We try to make those little guys feel good about, hitting the small numbers. But, just as long as they're improving, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
We did have one kid who was a little bit discouraged. And my idea of the week was to get them to do a 6:30 a.m. Zoom call.
That's early.
So now we're doing – well, the only time we could get them together was – before school.
Okay.
So that's the one time where they were all available. So I said, I had a story when I was back in high school. I told them about how I was on a football team.
Yeah.
And when you get all 50 guys after practice going into the weight room together, mm-hmm. you're motivated. When you have 50 guys doing it, the team looks out for you. The team encourages you.
Yeah.
So, telling one kid to go home and do push-ups is not as easy as getting three or four friends together and saying, hey, we've got each other's back. We're going to motivate each other to do this every morning.
It's like your workout partner.
Exactly. So a big lesson right there.
When you're not feeling 100%, but, the other guy is going to be there, it makes you accountable. So you push yourself. So it's great. It makes total sense.
Okay, so let's hear about your experiences with exercising at home and weight training. What was it like back in the day?
I mean, back in the day, the players didn't train as much as they do now. Like when I see my son work out, it's just through the roof. I did a lot of just on ice scrimmaging, skating that way, but spent a lot of time on the ice. But I think I also worked a lot of my stick handling off the ice, imagining – watching a game and stick handling with a golf ball with a figure eight out to one hand, then back in, and then, just moving your head and toe drags, little things like that. That's just what I did. But also, when I got about 12, 13, wanted to get a little stronger, started doing a bit of push-ups, 20 push-ups, and then weight, do those three times, and just slowly get the strength up in the sense of knowing that the players are going to get bigger and stronger. Those are the kind of things that I did. And then eventually, once you got 15, 16, you were kind of in a routine with your team. They had weight training, three times a week. Not that I was any good at it, but I just followed protocol. Until I really started doing weights was more, I would say, in my 20s, because I needed to build my upper body a little bit. My legs were always strong because I was on the ice almost every day. I was just skating 3-4 hours a day and not really focused on the upper body. But it's important as you play against bigger and stronger players. It's all about core strength, being strong on your skates. You don't have to be the biggest guy up top, but if you're strong on your skates, it makes a big difference, You look at some other smaller players, Martin St. Louis, he built his legs up incredible size, strength. Paul Kariya, same thing. Theo Fleury, he was just a big bundle of hate, and he was just one of those guys that was strong as an ox on his skates, and he was a lot smaller than me. So even if you're smaller, get strong in your legs and your hips, and that's going to make you a much more dangerous player.
Obviously, times have changed. And what was it like for Ty training? Do you remember when he started taking it seriously?
I would say, I look back, Ty was kind of training when he was playing with the Vancouver Selects. I would say, so he was, once again, back to 12 years old. He was doing his 12-minute run, they called it. You got to try to do it under 2 minutes. It's very difficult. So if you're between 12 minutes and 13 minutes doing two miles, which is eight times around a track, That's kind of telling you how your overall aerobic and anaerobic is. And then, you know, same thing. They start doing a little bit of weights, you know, like the bench with maybe 10 pounds on it, and then it moves up to 25. But you never try to, at that age, 12 to 15 is a real delicate age because their bones and ligaments are growing and expanding, and you can really do some damage. So it's something you're more or less want to teach them between 12 and 15, the motion of what proper technique is when you are lifting. And a lot of times it's with just the bar and no weights. It's teaching them the proper motion. And then once they get around 15, you definitely can start putting some weight on there. And, you know, like, there's a lot of things that can hurt you. If you do squats the wrong way, that you can get hurt. So I think early on, I really, you know, doing lunges, single lunges, that's important. And jumping up on the box is huge because it's all leg power. So what that does, you know, you have it here, I see, and it's about driving the first step, the first two steps to get away from someone. So that's very important in the game of hockey.
Yeah, so we've got that going with the kids. I'm focused every day on about 15 minutes of dry land training, waking up in the morning, 6:30, and everybody feels good. That's They're telling great. Me right now that it makes their whole day a little bit better when they get that energy first thing in the morning.
Hey, I try to go golfing at 6:30 in the morning, and I walk the course. See, I'm a little bit older, but I feel better the rest of the day because I walked, you know, 8-10 kilometers, depends how bad I'm playing. And just exercise is good for the mind. So if you get it done early, the rest of your day just feels like you're in a good mood. Everything is going your way. And I think by doing that, you really create an atmosphere of what champions do. And that's what champions do.
Exactly. Okay, so that's the physical side of things. Yeah. We obviously need to make sure that these kids are eating right as well. So how important is nutrition for kids, and at what age? I mean, so many kids in here, I look at their parents when I start talking about nutrition, and they're kind of like rolling their eyes, like, how do I get my kid to, you know, start eating properly? Because, I mean, it's a big part of
eating
learning
is huge.
How,
if you want to grow, I mean, you got to eat good foods. I would never eat potato chips again. It's probably the worst thing you can do. That ain't going to help you. You know, soda pop, not good for you. But, you know, you're a young kid and you're growing. I think it's important to eat, you know, if you're active, the pastas are easy to eat, the different rice dishes, the, you know, obviously chicken is good if you're looking for protein. You know, I really think just having a good solid diet is important, but also, if you're working out hard, you got to fuel your body, and you just try to stay away from the sugary type foods, and it will help you to grow, but also overall feel better.
Did you and Ty ever do protein shakes?
I did the protein shakes, yeah. And I had a hard time. I think I had a bit of issues with the protein, like the whey protein, just maybe it's genetics or whatever, but Ty didn't have problems with it. He still does it. It's a regimen. Ty does a lot of yoga. That's what he usually does, is yoga before he does his workout, and then he gets in his routine. But maybe one of these times we'll show you some of the clips of what he does. It's pretty crazy.
Let's start talking about the NHL. I'm trying to get these kids excited about the playoffs. And for a lot of kids to watch a three-hour playoff game day after day after day, they don't really have the attention span. So how do we get these kids excited about the playoffs?
Well, I think it's important. I mean, we grew up following one team. So pick a team, pick a player, and follow that player like it's you. Meaning, you know, for instance, if I was now watching, obviously the Canucks are out, but because I played in different cities, you know, I follow them, or I know certain players that are playing on different teams, or I know coaches that I played for, and you want them to do well. But for me, I really enjoy watching Braden Point right now because I like watching Tampa. They play a wide open style, but this little Braden Point, you know, is something else with his ability to skate. The Boston Bruins, as much as Canuck fans, we don't like them. They, you got to take your hat off to Marchand. He's just a little tiny guy, but you know what? Of all the players, he's got so many avenues in his game. But when the game's on the line, this guy comes up big every time, and he gets knocked around last series. So if he keeps doing what he's doing, he'll probably end up being the MVP of this whole thing. It's exciting for the young kids, I think, to really follow a player you like, but also follow a team that that you enjoy watching or your dad might enjoy. Like, there's a lot of Montreal Canadian fans out here, Toronto fans. So, you know, a lot of good players out there that you can watch and cheer them on.
I feel a certain energy when the Canucks are doing well with the kids that are coming in here. They are excited about the Canucks doing well. So when the Canucks aren't doing very well, I kind of feel like it hurts hockey in the city. Yeah, do you feel like that as well?
Absolutely. I mean, you know what? When the playoffs come around, I remember when I was in the playoffs almost every year I played for 19 years, I think 16 of them were in the playoffs. And it's a different atmosphere. It's exciting. It's new. You know that you're playing against the best, and the best are going to be trying their hardest. So you had to take your game to a different level. So in this city, it's always been special because – you know, you watch the games when there's fans, especially in the States right now. The one thing the Canucks had an advantage, not so much the team, but the Canuck fans were loud. They were in playoffs. It was such a treat to play in front of them. They gave everyone energy and they gave everyone courage. And I really think that hurt the Canucks this year because I think – the Canuck team really depends on their fans more than most teams. You need that, you know, excitement of guys and girls and kids cheering for you, knowing just give it everything you got. And I don't think they had that, and I think it really affected them.
I love our Vancouver Canucks core team. This, like, when I think of the Canucks right now, I love every player on the team, and I don't want to see trades. I'm listening to the radio and they're criticizing the players and they're saying we got to make moves and all this kind of stuff. And I think about all the teams we've had. Don't you just have to be patient?
I mean, you can be patient with your top six, right? But and your top four D. But right now, they don't feel they have top four D. I think they feel they got three. They got three to go. To be at that level of some of these teams like Tampa, that I mean, Trimackin would have helped a player like that that clears the front of the net, meat and potatoes type player. I mean, the teams that do really well in the playoffs, you know, you have your offensive stars, but you need those guys that are just, like, hard to play against. You know, like, I remember playing against the Oilers in playoffs and, you know, everyone knows their top players and Coffees, and he'd wind up, and you'd know to angle him. And Gretzky, you know he's going to make a great play, so you're looking for who he's going to pass to. But, you know, trying to get to the net with Kevin Lowe there, it was, you know, he'd accidentally club you on the top of your foot, or, you know, Charlie Huddy, you know, he'd throw kind of an elbow to your head, but he'd be saying, hey, sorry about that, bud. You know, like, just a gentleman, but just not mean, but it was to a point. You know, Marty McSorley, when he was there, I think the Canucks have to go, you know, in that aspect of a really, you know, their other 3D are just mean, no fun, Gerald Dittick, you know, type defenseman. And, you know, Dave Babich was like that. He could make plays, but they just clear the front of the net, and they would pound you if you came near the crease. And, you know, you even watch Winnipeg. They're not the best team right now, but they got some big D that you get to the net, you're getting hit pretty good.
Old 94 Canucks, eh? So do you ever get flashbacks when you're watching the playoffs and say,
Yeah.
I can feel this. Like this brings me back to those days when I was in the playoffs.
Absolutely. I mean, I look at this game where we see up here that's in Winnipeg, and it's called the Whiteout. No one's there, but every seat has a white towel. And that rink was so loud. It was fun to play there, but it was intimidating and loud. I mean, you pick up stuff when you played, like you remember what it felt like, what it smelt like. Like going into the Coliseum before the game, you could smell the popcorn. The popcorn machine, they made it downstairs. It went right through the whole place. Like when you enter into a building, the smells and the people,
the sounds.
That's what is really cool about different rinks, and they bring on their own character. So that's what I remember when I watch these games. And
what do you remember about walking into the Coliseum? Do you have any specific memories?
Yeah, I mean, pulling into the parking lot. I was really regimented. I think as a hockey player, it's important. Yes, I had rituals. I tried to slow them down, but it was more. I arrive at 4 o'clock, you know, I walk through that door, whatever, four or whatever, by the time I walk a couple hundred yards, it'd be the same gentleman there at the door. Hey, how's it going? And then he'd always say, hey, have a good one tonight. And, you know, you kind of just that extra 100 yards walking to the dressing room, you'd be kind of thinking, okay, it's going to be a good night. You know, you got to make sure you're going, get in the dressing room. And then once you got in the dressing room, you saw the trainers and just kind of settle down, grab your sticks, and it's kind of a reflection time of getting your mind and body ready for the game. So it became very, you know, after playing 1,300 games at a pro level, it never became a job, but there was times it was, you know, it was a battle to make sure that you were ready to play, because mentally it's a long year sometimes.
Actually, let's get back to the playoffs here. I want to talk a little bit about the John Tavares injury. Yeah. So in that injury, John Tavares is avoiding a check. And it happened last year. I don't know if you remember, but Mark Scheifele of the Winnipeg Jets was coming down the boards, and he kind of, Matt Tkachuk is coming at him, and he does this quick little button hook.
Yeah.
And Matthew Tkachuk reaches with his leg and clips him right on the ankle, and probably injured Scheifele out for the rest of the game.
Yeah.
And me and my buddies got into a big discussion about that, how cheap that was. And then one of my friends says, hey, you should have taken the hit. Instead of pulling away, trying to avoid a hit, much like Tavares did,
yeah,
kind of puts you in a vulnerable position.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what type of player you are. There was times I would avoid a hit. There was times you couldn't avoid the hit. And a lot of times you couldn't avoid the hit, especially for a smaller player, is at the blue lines, getting the puck in or getting the puck out. Those are crucial areas that you have to pay the price at all costs. And if that means that you're going to be knocked out, you have to get the puck out. That's your job along the wall. You see that quite a bit. You know, I saw what happened to Tavares. It was a kind of a freak accident. It happened so fast. It was just an explosion of getting hit and spinning off, coming off the hit. And then the other player's looking up ice to see who he has to pick up. And at the last second, he just tried to get out of the way. But, you know, if Perry was 5'8", there wouldn't have been a problem. And you can't determine that, you know, because he's 6'4", that his knee just happened to be where he was falling. So, you know what? Corey Perry, yes, he's a very dirty player. Yes, he's done crazy things before that was obvious. But this time, I'd have to say it was a complete accident. And, you know, I think they made the right call. It wasn't, you know, it didn't bother me when they fought at the end, because Corey Perry's been around the game a long time and just knew that, let's just do this, get it over with so everyone can play hockey. I didn't want to hurt the guy. So, you know what? Sometimes you got to take your hat off to those guys that they've been around a long time. And, you know, even in the fight at the end, he kind of just bailed and went down because he really didn't want to fight. It was kind of a strange situation.
Is that the code of the NHL when things happen like that?
Well, when you take out your captain or best player, regardless if you think it was on purpose or not, someone's got to go answer the bell. It's just the way it is.
Does that bring you back to any situations that you've been around where players just had to take it into their own hands?
Well, I mean,
or does it happen that
myself,
much?
I never had to take it in my own hands. I always had a guy protect me, even in junior hockey. Craig Berube, Todd Ewan, late Todd Ewan. I had a lot of tough guys that protected. I was a small guy. I tried to stay out of trouble, and they didn't mind protecting me as long as I didn't start it. But, you know, when I look back, Gene Ojek in the NHL, you knew he was there. As long as you didn't start it, he's going to protect you. Most teams have a guy like that. Maybe not so much now, but I think you're going to see it come around a little bit more now. Everyone's going to make sure they got a guy protecting their $11 million players out there.
Have you ever had a bad concussion?
Yeah. I had a real bad concussion in training camp in Phoenix. It was scary. You know, I got hit. I hit the back of my head. And growing up, trying to be tough and pretending like nothing's wrong, I went and lined up. Supposedly what they said is I lined up on the wrong side of the puck, taking a face off. And they asked me if I'm all right. And I go, well, what's wrong? Well, you're on the wrong side. And I'm like, oh. And then right away they took me off and I had to go to L.A. to get tested, and I was out for 6 weeks. And that was hard. Coming back from a bad concussion is hard because you are nervous that you're not sure if you're 100%, because you start doubting yourself. And finally you get over it, you feel better, get in some practices. And I was fortunate that, you know, I went on to play and stayed fairly safe after that.
I remember that feeling when I knocked my teeth out.
Yeah.
The first game back after knocking my front teeth out, I was very unsure of myself and, just kind of shell-shocked, I guess.
Yeah, you got to be cautious now. When we played hockey in junior, there's so many guys that got concussions, but you had to be tough and you couldn't admit it. So you had to actually just play through it. You're not even knowing what you're doing, but it's kind of sad, but that's the way it was. You know, look in the Barry Beck days and Stan Smeal back in those days. You didn't want to like look weak, which is a sad thing because you got to make sure you protect the most important thing and that's your brain. So, if you get knocked really hard, you just got to make sure that you're okay for all those kids out there.
All right, so what's your predictions for the Stanley Cup Finals this year?
I'll tell you what. Earlier, I had, different vision, and then I've got to watch some games, pretty intense games, but Colorado's really impressed me. So Colorado's coming from one side, and I like the way Tampa and Boston been playing. Originally, I thought Washington be going far, but they got beat by a good defensive hockey team. So I got to stick with my Tampa, Colorado. And Colorado is going to win the cup.
Okay,
I'm picking. McKinnon is going to get MVP.
Conn Smythe. Okay, I'm going to pick the Vegas Knights to make it to the finals. I like the way Fleury's playing. And my favorite player, my favorite two playoff players are Mark Stone and Alex Tuck.
Yeah. Talks good.
These guys are just monsters. And
what's interesting is Stone isn't a very good skater. So how intelligent is he as a hockey player? It's very, very intelligent player.
On the east side, I'm picking the New York Islanders just because Matt Barzal
is
from my hometown, Coquitlam.
And he's a good coach. I played for him, Barry Trotz.
All right, I want to get to questions now. Actually, before I get to these questions, I want to ask my own question. We're starting to work on different things in here with certain players that have been coming here for a while, and I think a couple of the centermen want to know some draws. Yep. So you're a centerman, and you must have a few tricks in your bag.
Yeah, what's happened now is they've changed the way you line up, the way the you know, inside the circle, there's a little line here and a little line here. So one thing I was taught that you actually want your blade to be on an angle like this, not going in unless you're going to lift up and then kick the puck or lift up. So this gives you an advantage to have your stick on this angle as much as you can.
Maybe so you're pulling the puck back?
Well, cause, no, when they drop, you're going, you're practicing going forward, back.
Right.
So you're forward, back on your backhand, right? And if you're going on your forehand, it's the same thing, you're scooping. But it's really the position. I guess we should demonstrate next time, but it's really the position when you enter in, how your stick is angled. A lot of kids, if this is the circle, they come in like this, and then yeah. they go, and then back. This way, you're already in a position to pull the puck back, so you're one step ahead. So it's, you get it, you go forward, back. That's it. So it's only one motion, forward, back. This one's up, back, right? It's totally, you're so far behind. Now, if you're going to go on your forehand, you're going to lift the stick up, you can do that. But most of the guys, you watch the best ones now. This guy's got his stick like this. This guy's got his stick like this. And just watch different high-end, well, Bergeron, probably one of the best. You know, Matty Barzell, actually not bad, too. He, same thing. And Adam Oates was the one guy that, when I played with, really taught me the different little tricks on face-offs of all things, when I played for the Canucks, Pat Quinn brought in a guy named Clint Smith, played for the Boston Bruins, and he was known to be one of the best face-off guys. Because I guess I was getting destroyed in the playoffs one year, like 26%. He brought in Clint Smith and taught me about the different positions also. And explaining, if you're a smaller guy, it's all about quickness. You got to outquick the guy and time it, outquick him. Because you're not going to out-muscle some guy that's a...
You're never attacking the other guy's stick.
It depends. It depends if he's got slow hands. But most of the time, I'm trying to beat him just because I'm a lot quicker with the hands and reaction time. But that depends on the type of player, for yep. sure.
I remember there was one game when I was in minor hockey, and this kid, just every single face-off, before the referee dropped the puck, mm-hmm. he just kind of cross-checked my stick. Referee would drop the puck and then boom back.
Yeah.
And I learned that move that one game, and then I just started using it myself. And I went a good, and still nowadays in adult rec hockey, beer league hockey, I still use it. It's a great move.
But if you do that yeah. I know for a fact, if you do that like to a pro or to a guy that, you know, is a pretty decent player,
yep.
you do that once or twice, he's going to come in, he's going to go like this, and he's going to get you like this. With his stick in the end, like
Bergeron on Crosby the other day.
Exactly, right? So you got to be careful. Do it once, but then back off and come up with another thing. So
okay,
yeah.
Bruce from Richmond, what was the best trick shot you've ever seen?
Probably the best tricks I've ever seen. I was playing with Gary Lehman in a tournament out in Ontario. We were doing a charity tournament, and it went into a shootout, and he came in, crossed over the blue line, and did this play that he actually got his stick, kicked the puck with his stick on the blade,
right.
and it went top shelf, like it went like 80 miles an hour, and the goalie wasn't even ready for it, but it was like, oh my god, like right across the blue line, and he just pretty well drop kicked the puck top shelf. I mean, I've seen a lot of great plays, but that was something that I've never seen. To execute that again would be pretty well impossible.
I saw you do the one with the tweener, the one between yeah. the legs in Russia.
And yeah.
You were on was that a penalty shot that they gave you?
Yeah, I was against the Russian. I went over there. I had such a good time. I was so lucky. You know, I'm playing with Mark Messier. Our coach is Phil Esposito, Glenn Anderson, and we're playing a game. You know, it's going right across Russia, this game, and we're playing against their legends, and they had everyone there. They had Krutov, Larionov, Fedosov, McGillney, Burray, name a Russian. They were there. Like, it was, they were so stacked, but somehow our team did pretty good. And I think it went into a shootout or something, and then I came down and did that move and then went underneath between my legs up over the goalie. And even Messier said, hey, nice shot, kid. So it was fun.
All right, last question. Jody from Nashville, why hasn't a Canadian team won the Stanley Cup in almost 30 years?
Well, I hate to say it, but I think really for what I, this is my own personal opinion only. I think what it is, you know, you get the star players and, you know, they're making some pretty good coin and they have options. They can go, you know, quite frankly, they can go play in Florida, Tampa. They can go play somewhere in the States that has warmer climate or the wife might want them to be playing, Phoenix, Arizona. You know, it's what happens, I think, is maybe they don't want to go to Edmonton because it's cold. Winnipeg, it gets cold. Vancouver, it might rain too much. It gets gloomy during the winter. You know, I mean, Vancouver is one of the nicest cities in the world when the sun comes out. So I think a lot of times they got one career and, you know, but that can change because it really, if players start getting the feel of this is the place to be to win, like in 2011, that was a good hockey team that could have won. And they had a lot of depth. That was a year they had a lot of depth. And once again, their D were mean. Remember that. It's no fun playing against their bottom four D that can really punish you and make it hard on you. So, yeah, that's, I think that mostly it's because they want to play in a nice city that has nice weather. Maybe it's shopping's better for the wives. I don't know, but that could be it.
Here's my theory. We've got a media that is totally focused on the Canucks here in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. So what I mean by that is that I heard the reporters talking on AM650 one day in February or March. Yeah, it was March, during March Madness, the NCAA basketball tournament.
Yeah.
And there's this incredible story about Gonzaga University in Spokane in Washington. Yeah. And they've gone the whole season undefeated, and they want to talk about it. But they're joking about how their producers are saying, you got to push hockey, you got to push hockey, you got to push hockey. And then a light bulb went off in my head, and now I know why there's so much negativity on the Canucks on in the media. You've got all these other cities that have football, baseball, basketball in the States. That's their main sports.
That's true.
So the media over there is told to, like, you know, spread it out.
Yeah.
And so they basically report mostly on the facts of what's going on in the games, especially in the hockey. They're not going to look for too much. But when you're told to report, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, Canucks, 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 you're gonna run out of facts and you're going to get into opinion. And when you get into opinion, eventually you're going to start putting a lot of negativity on the air.
That's so true. And if you think it's tough here, you go to Toronto, and then you go to Montreal, it's double pressure. And that's something that obviously is also maybe why some of the players don't want to come, because of the media is just completely hounding you the whole time. Like, it is something that can drag you down when, you know, when you're not playing so good at times, that it's overbearing for players to get over it and just go out and play their best, for sure.
I remember Roberto Luongo, a perfect story. He's leading the team to the 2011 Stanley Cup Finals.
Yeah.
And how much was the media on him after every game?
Yeah, it's true. There's a lot of pressure. You're right. In all those cities, like in Edmonton with McDavid, there must be so much pressure on him. You know, Austin Matthews. In Toronto, in Montreal, it's kind of dispersed, but Shea Weber takes most of the heat, or Carey Price. I mean, overall, That's so true. Because when I played like in Nashville, the people were just so happy to have hockey. And it wasn't totally about winning the cup. It was about competing and the players giving everything they have. And they love you when you do that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Great. That's exactly what I wanted to hear. I feel like that really cements the idea of, you know, just telling everybody stay positive.
Yeah.
You know, don't always listen to the radio, and you know, they're just looking for topics to talk about most of the time. And I feel like, you know, they get a lot of callers that come in, but the majority of people are Canucks fans are not calling in and complaining. You know, the majority, the few people that call in are just the people that are going to call in and complain about anything.
Well, I think most of the fans realize it's the NHL is tough to win at, and I think what they want is effort, and they want a commitment to do their best. And you know, the teams didn't have a lot of breaks this year, losing Pettersson, but you know what, I'm not giving them any excuses, because I think they have to get better. And sometimes you have to own up to it, and then you, it's almost like starting over with a whole new year ahead of them. And I'm hoping that they can pull this together quick and be ready for next year.
Awesome. Thank you, Cliff.
All right.
Everybody, thank you for watching. And we are the Slapshot Alley, www.slapshotalley.com. We teach NHL pro technique, shooting, wrist shot, snapshot, slap shot, backhanders, you name it. We can get your kid shooting fire. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week.